I don't know why the U.S. government decided to board up and pack away the Ark of the Covenant, but they did. You may remember that Indiana Jones was trying to keep the Ark of the Covenant out of the hands of the Nazis. Y'all remember this, right? Back during World War II, and they found the bad guys in a cave, and the bad guys wanted to open up the Ark, and Indiana and Marion, out of respect and reverence for God, closed their eyes, but everybody else left theirs open, and they got zapped by what was inside that Ark. You remember that? And so now the U.S. government had this Ark of the Covenant. You remember what they did at the end of the movie? They crated it up and put it in a warehouse and set it aside, hidden away, trying to forget about the power within. Now, that's based on a true story. If you've ever read 1 Samuel chapter 5 through 7, you've read that story. So I want to invite you to turn over to 1 Samuel chapter 5. As has been mentioned, we are looking at God's work in this world. We've been talking about how God has, from the very beginning of creation, worked in a creative way that from the perspective of humans could seem like chaos, yet God knew exactly what he was doing. But he also took some time for Sabbath. Remember day 7 of the creation. And this seems to be a consistent pattern in the work of God. You see this in stories over and over again. You see it, as we've mentioned, in the with the children of Israel going to the Red Sea, and it seemed like they were caught. And God led them to that point with the purpose, only to, at the last minute, part the seas and lead them out. Now, God knew what he was doing. They didn't. It seemed like chaos to them, but God knew exactly what he was doing. And you have in 1 Samuel a really good illustration of how God works and how he works in the life of Saul and how he works in the life of David. And both have a chance to respond to God's work. But as you will see in the future, Saul chooses poorly. David chooses well. But we're not there yet. Instead, we're looking at how the children of Israel respond before that. And they respond in a way that a lot of times we respond. You see, a lot of times what we do is when God calls us to rest in Sabbath, we want to move. And we can create our own chaos. And yet, when God moves, it can seem chaotic to us, and so oftentimes we'll reject that, and we'll get out of rhythm with God. Y'all were referencing earlier in the assembly the chaos going on in the United States. Can we safely guess that some of this chaos is not coming from God, but just from man's own movement? You realize, for example, that there is a part of our country that has succeeded. Right? It's about 6 blocks from Seattle. My sister and my brother-in-law used to live in Seattle. And so this place is near and dear to their heart. They've moved to a much more conservative region. They live in California now. But anyway, I digress. I think it's safe to guess that some of this we're seeing is chaos that's been created by man. And there'll be consequences from that. Yet I also believe God moves and has a way of harnessing what people do, even when they intend it for evil against God. God can use that. As a matter of fact, in the story in that we have here in 1 Samuel 5 and 6 and 7, you see how God can use even his enemies to do his will and to show his glory. Really today, folks, more than anything else, we're just going to brag on God. Is that okay? We're going to brag on God and what God can do. And this is a fun story to use to illustrate that. Because you have these people in this region that we call now Palestine, Israel. These people at this time are called the Philistines. Now here's what's really funny. When I was growing up, if some teenage boy was acting rudely and being barbaric, we'd say he's a Philistine. Because we thought the Philistines were uncivilized people. Actually, it was the other way around. According to the world standards, at this time, the Philistines are the ones that are civilized. They have a culture. They came over to this region by boat from other lands. They had iron. It was God's people that the world looked at as barbaric and uncivilized. They didn't have iron swords. They were basically a poor nation. Now, part of that is from their own choosing, because as we have studied, when God said, move into the land and clear it out of all the godless people, they stopped. They said, you know what, I think I want to start up a supermarket or a clothing store. I just want to rest and relax. I'm tired. I'm tired of advancing for God. And so they did. They were trying to have rest when God was calling for action. And so God would let, in the book of Judges, peoples come through to get God's people's attention. And that's one of the things he allows with the Philistines. And so they come in, and if you look at chapter, let's look at 1 Samuel chapter, let's look at chapter 4. Would that be okay? 1 Samuel chapter 4, I want you to look at the last part of verse 1. Now the Philistines went out to fight, now the Israelites went out to fight against the Philistines, and the Israelites camped at Ebenezer, and the Philistines at Aphek. And the Philistines deployed their forces to meet Israel. And as the battle spread, Israel was defeated by the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 of them on the battlefield. And guess what it is they decide to do? They decide to capture the very representation of the presence of God, the Ark of the Covenant. And they decide to show off. They're going to take that Ark back to their own place, and they're going to put that Ark in their own temple, and they're going to have that Ark bow down before their God. So you skip over to chapter 5. And Israel's lamenting this. Last part of chapter 4, they say the glory has departed. This is a sad time for Israel. Chapter 5, verse 1, after the Philistines had captured the Ark of God, they took it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. And then they carried the Ark into Dagon's temple and set it before Dagon. When the people of Ashdod rose early the next day, there was Dagon fallen down before on his face on the ground before the Ark of the Lord. They took Dagon and put him back in his place. But the following morning when they rose, there was Dagon fallen on his face on the ground before the Ark of the Lord. Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, are you seeing a pattern here? Look at verse 5. That is why to this day, neither the priests of Dagon nor any others who enter into Dagon's temple at Ashdod step on the threshold. The Lord's hand was heavy on the people of Ashdod and its vicinity, and he brought upon them devastation and afflicted them with tumors. There's a lot of disagreement in the scholarship world as to what this meant. Was it sores all over the body? Some said that's what it was. Some said it was cancerous tumors. Some said it was, how should I phrase this? It was highly related and connected to Preparation H. All right, I'm just going to leave it there and let your imagination go with that. But at any rate, literally, that's not a joke. That is serious. That's what some commentators say that it was. But there's some kind of physical casualty that happens to the Philistines because the Lord's hand was heavy on them. So who's doing this? The Lord. What's he creating in the lives of the Philistines? Well, from their perspective, it's chaos, right? Because he's trying to get everybody at a better place than where they are right now. He's trying to rearrange this board. So verse 7, when the men of Ashdod saw what was happening, they said, the ark of the God of Israel must not stay here with us, because his hand is heavy upon us and upon Dagon our God. So they called together all the rulers of the Philistines and asked them, what shall we do with the ark of the God of Israel? They answered, have the ark of the God of Israel moved to Gath. So they moved the ark of the God of Israel. Okay, now stop, pause, and think what's happening here. There is some kind of recognition that from the Philistines that Israel has a God. There's some kind of recognition that he is out of his box. There's some kind of recognition when the God of Israel is unleashed, we cannot handle this. We do not want him here. Let's send him back to Israel. This is too much for us. And so they conspire to do that very thing. Now, verse 9. After they had moved it, the Lord's hand was against that city, thrown into a great panic. He afflicted the people of the city, both young and old, with an outbreak of tumors. So they sent the ark of God to Ekron. So they just keep moving it on because God keeps acting. As the ark of God was entering Ekron, the people of Ekron cried out, "They have brought the ark of the God of Israel around us to kill us and our people." So they called together all the rulers of the Philistines and said, "Send the ark of the God of Israel away. Let it go back to its own place, or it will kill us and our people." For death had filled the city with panic. God's hand was heavy upon it. And those who did not die were afflicted with tumors, and the outcry of the city went up to heaven. By the way, this sounds kind of familiar, doesn't it? Doesn't this sound like a pandemic to them? Get into verse 6. When the ark of the Lord had been in Philistine territory 7 months, the Philistines called for the priests and the diviners and said, "What shall we do with the ark of the Lord? Tell us how we shall send it back to his place." And then what they do is they contrive this elaborate system of getting the ark in as safe a way as possible back to Israel. Incidentally, you're going to see here a reference in verse 6. We're not going to read it, but there's some symbolism what they construct. Gold tumors, gold rats, because evidently God allowed a pandemic of rats to spread around the Philistines. And so they decide to build a cart. And they decide to get two cows, yoke them together, hitch them to the cart, put the ark on the cart. And if you look at verse 8, "Take the cart of the Lord and put it on the cart, and a chest beside it, put the gold objects you're sending back to him as a guilt offering. We are guilty. We're going to atone this to God. Send it on its way, but keep watching it." In other words, make sure it gets there. We don't want it to come back. We don't want this God to come back in our presence because he's brought disaster upon us. Verse 10, so they did this. They took the cart. They hitched it together. They send it back. Now, there's a border town, Beth Shemesh. If you look at verse 13, "Now the people of Beth Shemesh were harvesting their wheat in the valley, and when they looked up, they saw the ark, and they rejoiced at the sight." Why? Because these are God's people. They're at the border. Here comes the ark of God. Yay! Verse 14, "The ark came to the field of Joshua of Beth Shemesh, and there it stopped beside a large rock. The people chopped up the wood of the cart and sacrificed the cows as a burnt offering to the Lord." Yay! The ark has returned to us. Verse 15, "The Levites took down the ark of the Lord together with the chest containing the gold object and placed it on the large rock. They offered up burnt offerings and sacrifices." The rulers of the Philistines saw this. Now I'm summarizing here. And they're glad. The ark has made it back. Good. Their God is away from us. Pandemonium will now subside. If you look at verse 19, "But God struck down some of the men of Beth Shemesh, putting 70 of them to death." Okay? Now these are God's people. God put 70 of them to death. Why? Because, last part of verse 19, "They had looked into the ark of the Lord. The people mourned because of the heavy blow the Lord had dealt them. And the men of Beth Shemesh asked, 'Who can stand in the presence of the Lord, this holy God? To whom will the ark go up from here?' Then they sent messengers to the people of Kiriath Jearim, saying, 'The Philistines have returned the ark of the Lord. Come down here and take it up to your place.' So the men of Kiriath Jearim came and took the ark of the Lord. They took it to Abinadab's house on the hill and consecrated Eleazar, his son, to guard the ark of the Lord." Now, let's summarize what's going on here. God's enemies take the ark. God is unleashed. They don't like it. They send it back to God's people. They send the ark back to God's people. Some of God's people do something they were not supposed to do. And if you look back in the first five books of the Bible, as the Lord is instructing His people what to do with the Ark of the Covenant, one of the things He says is you got to treat it reverently. You got to treat it with holiness. And they don't. They treat it like a car where they're kicking the tires. They open it up, do what they're not supposed to do, and God kills them. And so one of the things I think this story teaches us is you can't keep God in a box. And yet, if you invite God into your presence, beware, because God moves, God acts, God has a plan, God has a work that He's working on. And there's a part of this that's a mystery, because we don't know the mind of God. And that can make it very tough to walk with God. When God moves, when we walk with Him, remember following the cloud, the wilderness, things happen. And then when He tells us to stop, sometimes we want to move and we got to stop and rest and wait on God. We can't get ahead of God. And so it can be a dangerous thing to walk with God. Dangerous from my perspective. God doesn't welcome the curious. God welcomes the reverent. And so one of the things I want this story to nail down for us is that there is a call to observe the holiness of God, to treat Him with reverence, to understand that there are parts of God's mind we will never capture. We will never gather in this lifetime. And we have to be okay with that. And we have to respect that. We have to treat God with holiness. There is an old TV show called House. Does anybody remember when this was on? House, the lead character was this atheist doctor who had the temperament of an atheist. He was just a mean guy. He was brilliant. He was a genius, but he had no people skills. And you would see this in his practice, which made the series kind of interesting. Well, there was one episode that I loved because it dealt with this woman who was going to have a baby. But there's something wrong when the baby was in this womb. And so the woman needed to have an operation. And since House was the best doctor, he was going to do the surgery. Now, House didn't look at babies in the womb as babies in the womb. He looked at them as, he called them fetuses. They were things. And so this episode, which actually was loosely based on a true story, in this episode, as it unfolds, House does this surgery. And he's all-knowing. He's God, right? And he's doing this surgery on this woman, trying to rescue this woman. This thing inside of her is a problem. And he opens up, and his finger is inside the woman's womb. And he's trying to do surgery on the woman and the baby, because they're going to try to save what we call the baby. He calls the fetus. So from his perspective, he's working on this fetus, and all of a sudden, this tiny hand reaches up and grabs his finger. And House is trumped, and he looks with wonder. And I thought the TV show did a marvelous job of capturing this cynical, sometimes sinister human being who is so smart and so gifted, who thinks he knows everything, and yet in this moment, the awe of this baby in the womb captures him. And he is in wonder. And the day is going to come for all people when that's going to happen. No, not with a baby in the womb. But when, as Paul in the Philippians tells us, that every knee shall bow. At some point, we will all bow down before the wonder and the mystery of God. All people. And recognize that. But we're not there yet. We are not there yet. We as Christians need to be there though. We need to be at that place where we honor God. We have reverence for Him. We understand that we cannot understand His mind totally, but we can love Him and follow Him. People have a yearning to follow God. Actually, people have a yearning to recognize the spiritual part and to acknowledge the fact that they do not have all answers. I find it interesting that you can go on the East Coast or the Left Coast. You can go to either one of those places and you can find some of the most educated people on the planet. And you'll find, for example, this stockbroker who lives in New York City who rejects the thought of a holy God, who rejects the thought of a holy Christ. He is his own man. He will go and he'll make his millions of dollars and he'll go home in the evening to his apartment, this beautiful apartment in New York City that literally costs millions of dollars, and he will go into his living room where he has a shrine of crystals. And in the spirit of the New Age, he will bow down and worship. Even he needs some sort of recognition to bow down before the mysterious. He rejects God, but he understands that part of his nature. And know that we can cultivate that relationship to get him and others like him to recognize a true God and to convert to him. But we need to understand, as we start headed toward a conclusion, that we, if we're not careful, want to put God in a box. Look how long these people of God kept the Ark of the Covenant away from them. It was a long time, 20 years in all, that the Ark remained at Kiriath Jearim. We can't handle God in our midst. Let's put him over here. That is a convenient thing to do. And let's face it, sometimes as God's people, we want to put God in a box and not interact with him, not deal with him. Oh, we'll sing songs about it, but really that close personal relationship where we're responsible for him is so easy to put him in a box and put him over here. To see him on Sundays from a distance, but then to go to our homes and try not to have to deal with him. Because if we can avoid God, we can avoid dealing with the sin in our lives. If we can avoid God, we can avoid repenting of the sin in our lives. If we can avoid God, we can avoid walking with God. If we can avoid God, we can avoid having God transform us. If we can avoid God, we can avoid partnering with God in his work. Sometimes life seems easier if God's not moving. And we got to watch out for that. Churches. We as churches have to watch out about putting God in a box. It is such an easy temptation to want to say, oh, that God would help this church to grow, and yet at the same time, stay safe where we are. I'm reminded of a commercial a few years ago. I can't remember what it's for. I think it's for a credit card. But in the commercial, you got two young entrepreneurs, and they're talking, and one of them is really upset and very anxious. And the other partner, very calm, says, what's wrong? And the anxious one says, well, business is getting so big, we're going to have to open up another location. Well, what's wrong with that? Well, that means we're going to have to buy some more supplies. And we're going to have to hire more people. And you can just see the anxiety level increase. And finally, the calm partner says, but isn't this the idea? And so the thought theory is, yes, the anxious partner always said, we want to succeed in this, but deep down inside, he had a fear of where that would take him. It was safer to stay stable and to not grow. You know, churches can do that. Churches can do that, and many do. I'm reminded of growing up in Winsboro one summer night. It was in the evening, and it was four or five of us, my friends and I. We were probably in the seventh grade. And we were bored, and my mom said, you want to play kick the can? What's kick the can? Oh, it's a fun game. It's kind of like hide and seek. You get a can, an empty can, and you have one person who's it, and he kicks the can. And everybody else goes and hide. And the person who's it gets the can, stacks it back up where it belongs, and he counts to 50 with his eyes closed. And then he goes and finds everybody. And when he finds somebody, he brings them back to the spot behind the can. That's prison. Now, if he's out and somebody who's free comes in and kicks the can before he does, the it guy has to go get the can, put it back up. And meanwhile, everybody in jail can escape. And you start the process all over again until he catches everybody. Well, that sounds like a fun game to us. And we played it, and it was sensational. So when school started about a month later, we went back to school, and we told everybody about our game. And so informally, this network began, this groundswell of support. And people by the time the eighth grade said, hey, we want to play this game. So we planned one Saturday night to host all our friends in eighth grade over to play kick the can. Now, by that time, it got dark early, so we started after dark. Big mistake. We had dozens of kids. Another big mistake. We didn't know how to handle all the growth. And so I think I was the first one who was it. And the problem was, you had a number of kids go scattering out into the night. We had about 4.5 acres, so it was hard to find them. You had groups of kids who decided, you know what, it's more fun just to sit here and talk. And so they weren't even playing. And then you had other groups of kids who would pair up and go have romantic events. And that certainly wasn't fun. In other words, folks, it was a complete fiasco. It was just too hard to grow. And you know what we decided? We're not going to do this anymore. And we haven't. To this day, we've never played Kick the Can again together. Churches can be that way. They can start to grow. And God is unleashed. And there's pandemonium and chaos. And you start figuring out, oh, this is hard. Let's not play anymore. Beware of that. Incidentally, the nice thing about the DNA of this church is there was a time when this church was small and God was unleashed. Caddy, there's some hard work to be done those early days, wasn't there? I can remember when some of those guys were saying, some of those families, you know what, we need to build. We're going to personally pledge our lives, our fortunes, our badge of honor. Wait a minute, that's the founding fathers. But anyway, there was a lot of risk involved to accommodate a growing church. So I know it's in this church's DNA. If God chooses to unleash himself here, he can do it. And you've got it in your DNA if you want to partner with him. But will it be hard? Yeah, it will. It will at times seem like chaos. You may even have a visitor come in from California wearing shorts. What could be worse than that? By the way, that's my sister's fault. When he said, should I pack some long pants? She said, no, don't worry about it. I blame my sister for that. But I digress, ladies and gentlemen. All right, finishing up here. I really want to hammer this home before we start moving into Saul. We really need to watch out for rejecting God's rest for our own chaos and rejecting God's chaos for our own rest. Sometimes it can be deadly. This has been a while ago. You probably don't recognize. This is one of the finest young actors in Hollywood, Heath Ledger. Heath Ledger's last role won him an Academy Award. Sadly, he didn't live to see it. Died and was carried out of his apartment in a body bag. Incidentally, we all will someday. I've been with many a folk that have had this happen. That's how we're all going out. But what's sad about him was it didn't have to be so young. You see, when life was going well in his acting, he would get so intense, he would want to rest. And so he would take these artificial drugs to calm himself down and to give him rest. And it killed him. He died of an accidental drug overdose. And this was following a career where sometimes to play these characters, he gets so worked up, it would mess with his emotional system and his chemical system. And so he was all over the map, just messing himself up. We can do that. If we don't walk with God, we've got to honor God's movement, and we've got to honor God's rest. So I use this section to help us focus on that as we get ready to move into the next part and where we can turn to for idols if we're not careful. And we'll talk about that next week because God's people are not perfect. But I want to end with this. My wife's aunt married a guy whose family moved to Jordan when he was a teenager. And this kid grew up in New Mexico before that and had the highest marks in his class. They moved to Jordan. Why? Because his parents wanted to be foreign missionaries. This kid wasn't in. So this kid created his own chaos. 15 years old. He tanked his test scores. He quit working in the classroom. He was a rebellious mess until he got hepatitis. And he was put in a hospital as a 15-year-old for 3 weeks. And his hospital room was located at a spot to where he could look out the window at the Mount of Olives. And beyond that, on a clear day, he could see the Dead Sea. And as he sat in bed for 3 weeks, confined, he began to read his Bible. And God began to break him. And by the time he finished that confinement, his life was totally changed because his heart was changed. His scores improved, and he developed this desire to become a missionary. And he did. He went to Harding, graduated, came back, served in Jordan for several years. Then wanted to reproduce himself, went back to Harding, and became professor of missions. And then dean of the graduate school, and just recently retired. But I love that story because it shows us what happens when we get hard hearts and when we let God soften them. Now, his life has not been easy, but it has been fulfilling because he's been walking with God. Your life may not be that glamorous, but it can be equally fulfilling. And that's our call. Let's stand and let's sing.